Well, good afternoon, everyone. Who would have thought an accounting standard could be so exciting, eh? Okay, let's get underway. I'm Ian Lachlan. I'm chairing the task force, which is why I'm speaking to you right now. So first of all, what we're covering today is this. I just want to stress we're not here today to review the technical content of IFRS 17 or AASB 17. I'll come back to that. There's plenty of information online if you want to read about it. Rather, today what we're going to be talking about is what we're doing as a task force, how we're going about our job, what the issues are that we're grappling with, our plans from here, and so on. And also, it's an opportunity for you to ask questions, and we'd also like your input on our activities. So are we on the right track from your point of view? Are we tackling it in the right sort of way? What would you like us to be doing that we're not, and so on? So you get an opportunity to tell us that later on. The dates for implementation of the new standard you're probably well aware of, but it's worth bearing in mind. So formally, a year starting on or after 1 January 2021, but there is provision for early adoption from years starting from 1 January 18. So it's not far away if anybody's contemplating early adoption, and no doubt that'll get some airing today as well. The AASB, as you probably know, has adopted IFRS 17 pretty much unchanged, although I think there are some exceptions on public sector not-for-profits. So what is our purpose? That is the purpose of the task force. It's to help prepare the actuarial profession for the implementation of IFRS 17. Now, importantly, our focus is on Australia. Even though our members are more widespread than Australia, of course, our focus is on implementation of the standard in the Australian market. We've accepted the following responsibilities as listed on the page there. And they're fairly practical. They're intended to be fairly practical. So how should the standard be applied? What are the potential business implications? How might the industry respond? Develop a guidance document, and importantly for all three insurance industries, so life, general insurance and health. And our clear intent here is that we have consistency across those three industries. So we're not looking to have different interpretations, different specific applications to each industry unless it really is absolutely essential. So we also set ourselves a task of liaising with accounting bodies, APRA, ATO, IAA, AASB, FSA, SA, et cetera. But that's not the end of the list, as we found out. As we got into it, we also identified Treasury, ASIC, the Insurance Council, the FSC, the analyst community, and so on. So we've actually been out talking to all of those different parties, and we will continue to do that. And our intent here is to make sure we understand what their thinking is and what they're doing, but also so that we're really on top of it and preferably ahead of the game. The chair, I think Anne Driver is here, the chair of the AAALC, the Accountants and Actuaries Liaison Committee, sits in all of our meetings, so we've got a good connection there. And Brendan Council over here is also a member of the AAALC. The task force itself's got 14 members plus secretarial support. We've got representatives from life, general insurance and health insurance, as you would expect, given that's our scope. There are a lot more people involved also in the work stream. So the work streams have task force members and they have other members as well. We set ourselves some principles for the guidance, and this is quite important, and you want to make sure you're comfortable with this, I think. Before I go into the principles, I just touch on what the International Actuarial Association is doing. So they were quite heavily involved in the development of the standard. So they're in the process of producing what they call an ISAP. What's that stand for? International Standard of Actuarial Practice. So that's a principles-based document. I think that'll be produced in the near future. And that's going to be supported by a suite of International Actuarial Notes, they're called IANs. and they're in the process of being developed. Now, those IANs, from what we've seen, tend to be quite detailed and quite technical, and are pitched, therefore, at a fairly low level. We've taken a different stance. Given that backdrop to the IAA, we've taken the stance as reflected in the principles here. So reading our guidance should allow an experienced Australian actuary to implement the requirements of AASB 17 without having to read the IANs. Okay, so the IANs are there in the backdrop, and we don't want to replicate what's in the IANs, but we want to build on them. The initial guidance, which we're aiming maybe the end of this year, early next year, should be in the form of a structured Q&A with practical examples to illustrate key IFRS 17 principles. And that initial guidance will be initial. Okay, it'll be part of the education process, and then during the course of the next year or two, that will be refined and we'll get deeper and more better at the exercise. We're also keen to ensure that the terminology that's used across all of the subgroups, the work streams, is consistent. Okay, so let's have a quick look at the work streams. There are six of them. My colleagues here on the right look after each of those work streams. Hoa Bui is not here. She had a skiing accident, unfortunately. So she's not here, but between us, but in particular, Grant is going to step in for Hoa today. We also have APRA here, who are going to say a few words at the end, and you'll have a chance to ask them questions as well. Now, each work stream, I suppose it's fairly obvious, but each work stream is addressing our responsibilities in its particular area, and then the task force as a whole gets together and pulls it together. Our intention is to have a full-day workshop, I think it's now the 10th of November, where we'll be taking all of the work, the collective thinking of the work streams, and trying to pull it together into something sensible with the aim, as I say, of producing some guidance. Okay, let me, before I hand over to the work stream leaders, I just want to touch on some strategic and transition issues. So the impact of this standard, I think, is probably not well understood at a high level at the moment, but the possible impacts on capital levels, the return on capital, therefore, and if you mention those two things to a CEO, good chance they'll take some interest in what you've got to say. Regulatory capital, so we don't know what the position is on regulatory capital and what implications that might have for early adoption and transition arrangements. Profit might be more volatile, all other things being equal. Tax, there's a view out there in the marketplace, I think, that there's going to be this windfall, this tax windfall. I'm not so sure that's going to be the case, and I wouldn't be counting on it if I were you. So just bear that in mind, because again, if you say to your CEO that you might be able to save them some tax, again, I can promise you they'll be interested. And then there's an issue with transition accounting as well, which could be really quite complex, going from where we are now to the new arrangements. And all of that then has implications for early adoption. So there might be a desire to early adopt without understanding how difficult that will be. There might be implications for product design, for example, with so 1 year yearly renewable term might become 2 year renewable term, and you'll see why perhaps later on. Reinsurance, the treatment of reinsurance is quite different to the way it's currently treated. And that has some really quite interesting implications, I think. And potentially, I haven't got my head around this, but potentially for investments. So I hope that has got your pulses racing. And I'm now going to hand over to Benoit.
Thank you, Ian. Good afternoon. I'm Benoit Lagagnier, and I lead the aggregation and grouping work stream. Just a couple of words about the work stream. There's about 12 of us, and again, covering all the practice area in life, health, GI, reinsurance, and we also have a couple of folks from New Zealand as well on our work stream. So we are looking at mainly two issues, I guess, aggregation and how we go about it, and also contract boundaries. There's a few other peripheral issues, but these are the two main ones. The new standard deals much more specifically with these considerations, given its pure focus on insurance contract, as opposed to be more of a standard looking at insurance entities as such. So we thought the best way to go about framing the problem, if you want, was via more of a decision tree or a framework. And that was a way for us to basically highlight the key uncertainties, the key areas of interpretation. So on aggregation, the standard starts with an entity shall and identify portfolios. And the identification is whether these portfolios are subject to similar risk and managed together. Now, these words are not too dissimilar to what you can find in the current standards. However, there is a specific reference to product lines in the standard, and it does seem like it brings you to a greater level of details with those lines. Once you have reasonably homogeneous sets of portfolios, you can actually go about determining which valuation method you'll use, and there are fundamentally two main valuation: a building block approach, which is the general model, or if you qualify certain criteria, I guess, and these criteria are contracts 12 months or less, or if they are greater and the liability for remaining coverage is similar to the building block approach, you can qualify for a premium allocation approach, which is a simplified approach, very similar to the way general insurers will go about the current accounting standard, for example. With those valuation methods, you'll have to assess how the profitability level or how onerous some contracts will be, and that basically will form the groupings that you will use to value your portfolio. If you're in the general model building block approach, you'll basically have to assess in a minimum of three groups: being onerous, not likely to be onerous, and anything in between. If you go with the premium allocation approach, then you can assume at the onset that none of the contracts are onerous, and you will let fact and circumstances dictate how you manage your groups. One other important feature is that no group shall be more than 12 months apart in terms of inception of the contracts. So these have to be lots of 12 months, basically. Now, there's put a handful of questions there, but there are obviously quite a vast amount of subjectivity in there. So there are terms that will need to be defined or talked to. So what does fact and circumstances mean, for example? No significant possibility of being onerous. These are quite subjective terms, and they are all through the standards. So we are posing these questions and debating how to address those. Moving on to contract boundaries, and this is linked obviously to the previous diagram, especially when you go about the assessing whether you can be eligible to the premium allocation. You need to know the contract boundaries is 12 months or less. And basically, it all hinges on the practical ability to reprice or reflect the price or change the benefits, and that whether it's done on a policy by policy level. If not, you can still get away with a contract boundary. If at the portfolio level, you can do the same fundamentally. Again, similarly to the previous, there's quite a few terms that needs to be defined. What is practical ability, for example? And there'll be a whole raft of questions about specific products. So on life, for example, annually renewable life company contracts, multi-year insurance contracts, which have clause after at each year, for example, to reset some of the pricing components, etc. Health insurance, which is generally sold by the month. Are we looking at monthly contract or more long-term contracts? So quite a few questions to be debated. That's it for me in a nutshell. I'll pass on to Grant, who will talk about the building block approach.
Thanks, Benoit. I have the pleasure of leading the building block approach, which is the terminology that the ISB actually used during the development of the standard. It's now really referred to in there formally as the general measurement model. This basically means it generally applies to everything unless there's an exception. And so effectively it applies to short-term business, except that there's an exception there. So for the value of the future service component, you can use a nice simplified method. But the incurred claims are the same, regardless. And also for the variable fee or direct par business, which David will talk a bit more about later, again, you've got an exception for how you deal with the future service piece, but the incurred claims, totally the same, no variation. And if you want to understand a bit more about our task force, there's quite a range of people from a whole range of backgrounds. We've got a few Kiwis, but none are actually based in New Zealand on our task force. And we have a few reinsurers, health, life. And we discovered there is a wonderful and diverse world out there, and everybody's got an example of BBA, VFA, and everything else and somewhere. Even in the health insurance, they have some building block approach will apply to some contracts. If you want to understand more, there's a recent article in the Actuaries Digital, courtesy of Trang, we put out, would explain more about our activities, how we're tracking on there. And we also had a fairly useful discussion around a key topic, which is what is the coverage unit and what could that potentially actually mean? And that's what actually drives the release of this contractual service margin, or under MOZ terms, kind of a quasi-profit margin, and how it actually releases. Again, that's a topic that will probably go all the way through 2018 before somebody finally tells us what the words really mean. So lots more fun to come. But there's a really major developing issue, which is really what expenses can actually be included in the insurance contract liability measurement. And unfortunately for us, it also interacts rather badly, unless you like lots of work and doing things three times, with consolidation standard changes. And so I'll explain that in a bit more detail. So basically, in essence, to get into the measurement, the expenses need to be directly attributable to the portfolio. The question is, what do those words mean? Well, the only place you'll find them used in the standard is where they say directly attributable. They don't explain them in the standard. The basis for conclusion doesn't explain them. So you need to go off to a friendly accountant who will then tell you that effectively you need to look at similar words in the other IFRSs in accounting practice. And the outcome of that seems to be that the words effectively probably mean there has to be a fairly direct relationship. And probably anything that's an overhead at the portfolio level won't get into your measurement, which has a fairly big change. And so if you've got intergroup charges, they may be directly attributable in the short, depending how the charging structures work. But when you actually consolidate for the higher group, you may look through them and discover really they really are a large chunk of overhead, rents, other stuff, and they won't actually get into your insurance contract measurement on consolidation, even though they did back in your life company, your GI company, or your health company. The reason for that, unfortunately, comes from another little subtle change. 1023 and 1038 were very kind to us actuaries. They actually anchored the measurement of the insurance contract liability to the insurer. And hence, when you consolidated, it couldn't actually change, because it was the net liability of the insurers in the group accounts as well. That's no longer the case. It's the liability of the insurance contract, and it's basically whoever's doing the reporting, it's what they need to hold, and based on the view of that reporting entity. And hence a very simple example means, example, if you've actually got a group HR, they're actually charging basically whatever it is, $500 per employee into the life company. You could probably argue that all those employees in the life company are now direct, and so you can directly include it in you there. When you get to consolidate, you actually discover they've got a pretty, pretty general service desk. It's actually in a service contract out of possibly not even in Australia, whatever, and effectively it's really is an overhead. And so it will no longer be in your measurement on consolidation. The nasty piece of that is that not only just changes your insurance contract liability, it also changes all its components. It changes your expense experience. If your investment income allocation for your groups is driven off your policy liability, your policy liabilities just change, so that changes. Interest accretion expense on your CSM changes because your CSMs have just changed because they've got different levels of expenses inside the measurement. And then effectively, all the disclosures, those components and required reconciliations, which you need to do, which you'll see later when we get to our session, also will change. And potentially, even the group in which the contract falls, whether or not it's onerous, may actually change depending on whether or not you, the expense levels, when you did the original measurement in the life company or the GI company or the health company, and when you got to the group view. So good news is probably full employment. We can't find a solution for actuaries. I'm not sure it's fun employment. The other really big catch to all of this really does mean that there's a potentially a very significant disconnect with expenses used in past insurance liabilities and the profit shares under the Life Act, which is going to be a real challenge for both the companies and for APRA for going into this whole standard and how we actually all deal with the standard change. So that's about all on that one, but I'm sure the opportunity if you want to ask Q&As later. I'll hand over to David on BFA.
Okay. That's me. Okay. Now, the variable fee approach is basically like the general model, except that it basically allows for variations for investment-linked contracts or participating contracts. So as the assets go up, the liability goes up, the CSM goes up. As the assets go down, the liability goes down, the CSM goes down. So basically, it allows for that kind of variability, which the general model doesn't allow for. So the variable fee approach, it's been colloquially called the VFA, because people don't like long terms, they don't like three-letter acronyms. And the big question is, that people are going to ask invariably, is which products fall into the VFA and which products don't? Because if they don't, well, we don't need to worry about them. Now, under the standard, there are criteria for products that are eligible to use the VFA, and they're in paragraph B101 in the standard. So there are basically three criteria. First of all, the contract needs to be linked to a pool of underlying items, which for most, as you can understand, for most unit-linked business, for PAR business, there is already that pool of underlying items to which they're linked. The other thing is, the other two criteria use the word substantial. We've heard about the word significant. We have similar problems with the word substantial. The two criteria are that, first of all, the policyholder's share of returns needs to be substantial, i.e. the policyholder needs to get a substantial share of the returns versus the shareholder. So the question is going to be, is 80-20, which we typically have for participating businesses in Australia, is that substantial? Well, probably it is. We'd have a hell of a mess if it wasn't. Similarly, there is a third criteria that the share of the policyholder benefits that is variable needs to be substantial. So it's not, if the case is that the bulk of the benefit for the policyholders is basically fixed, so it's not variable as the underlying items vary, then that criteria won't be met. But again, what is substantial and what is not substantial is not necessarily well defined. One thing that is clear is that what is currently defined as participating in Australia and the Life Act and so forth will not necessarily be able to use the VFA. So that linkage to what we currently define as participating is not there. So we've grouped products as to whether they're likely to qualify to use the VFA, or they'll probably be able to use the VFA, or they'll probably not be able to use the VFA, and so on, so forth. To actually know for certain, you'll need to actually look at the contract details of the individual contract to see whether the criteria are met. But we think, broadly speaking, the VFA is likely to include basically participating conventional business that we currently write, investment-linked business, where it is bundled with a rider. Now, one of the things under AASB 17 is that they've changed the rules about bundling and unbundling. Typically, we currently, under the current rules, we basically unbundle investment-linked contracts. We put the investment-linked bit in one statutory fund, and we put the rider in another statutory fund. That won't necessarily be the case under AASB 17. But some things will be able to be unbundled, and you need to note that if that is the case, then the standalone investment-linked contracts or the investment component of investment-linked contracts that can be unbundled, they won't even be subject to AASB 17. You'll have to use some other accounting regime to measure those. So what we're looking at here is only those investment-linked businesses which can't be unbundled. They have to be bundled with a rider. Those are contracts that are probably going to be able to use the VFA. It basically depends on the size of the guarantee that those contracts have. If they have a big guarantee, then most of the benefit to policyholders won't be variable, and so they won't be able to satisfy that third criteria to meet the VFA. However, if the guarantee is small, then most of the benefit will be variable, and they will then satisfy the criteria. So we think participating investment account business will be able to use the VFA. We think that participating annuities, where such exist, will be able to use the VFA, and also non-participating investment account business. We think that will probably be able to use the VFA. Those contracts which probably won't be able to use the VFA are group risk products. Even though they may have a profit share, we don't think they'll be able to use the VFA. Two reasons. One is that most of the cash flows, most of the benefits come from a claim, so they're kind of fixed. The profit share is only a little bit on top. And secondly, there is, although it's not actually part of the criteria, there are words to the effect that the VFA only really applies to investment type contracts. And group risk contracts obviously aren't investment contracts. Now, just quickly, some other things that you need to think about and we're looking at in relation to the VFA. First of all, what things need to be done differently under AASB 17 that we currently do under MOS? So the first thing is level of aggregation. Benoit's mentioned that, and it's likely to be more granular than currently. The second thing is unbundling, and I mentioned that. You may not be able to unbundle where you previously were. The third thing is profit release. This will be different to what we currently have under MOS. At the moment under MOS, profit is basically released in proportion to a profit carrier, whereas now profit will basically be released, as Grant mentioned, in proportion to coverage units. And so the pattern of profit release is likely to be different under AASB 17, and it's likely to be more upfront than we used to. Also, AASB 17 requires that you hold a risk adjustment, and we'll talk about that later on. For life insurers, it will actually be new. But one thing to note is that the risk adjustment for VFA business only relates to the risks that the shareholder bears, not the risk that the policyholder bears. And last of all, There is also the issue of experience. Currently under AASB 17, the experience that's allowed for in profit is only the experience that arises from actual versus expected cash flows in the current period. Experience that results from changes in volumes of business, that's all absorbed into the CSM and emerges in the future. Doesn't emerge in the current period, which it does currently. The second thing is that we're interested to know what things will you do differently under the VFA versus the general model that you currently do under the BVA. So again, there is the question of experience, which depends on what items go through the pool. There is the issue of cash flows. So you need to include under the VFA the cash flows that result from bonuses. They also need to be included in any prediction that you do of the cash flows. The discounting under the VFA is slightly different to the general model. The discounting under the VFA, the contractual service margin unwinds at the current rate, the current earned rate, not the locked-in rate, which it does for everything else. And similarly, adjustments are done at the current rate, not at the historic earned rate. The locked-in rate at inception. There is then the question of what actually are the assets in the pool. The main requirement here is that companies don't necessarily need to hold the assets in the pool. There just needs to be a link to some pool somewhere for the benefits. There have been some paragraphs added to the standard just at the last minute almost around mutualisation. So that's basically where the cash flows for one group of products can be changed, can be increased or decreased because of what happens for another group of contracts. And you can kind of understand how that concept of mutualisation particularly relates to participating business and how there is a sharing of risk across cohorts and so forth. But the thing is that the cash flows that you're going to model aren't necessarily known in advance. So there are going to be some issues around those. There is issues around friendly societies and mutuals. Well, there may be some issues. As yet, we haven't yet addressed those, but there are likely to be some issues, particularly around friendly societies and how the VFA applies to them. And lastly, I want to say that there is also some discretionary business that can't use the VFA, that doesn't meet the criteria that I mentioned earlier on, but it's still discretionary. And the idea is that such business will be able to use the general model, but changes in that future discretion won't affect the current period profit, they'll be absorbed in the future. The last thing I want to say is most of the examples that have been produced that you might see around the place, they basically relate to, there might be one, Grant will tell me if there is actually one, but basically most of the examples that have been produced relate to unit-linked business. There are very few, if any, examples that exist in relation to traditional participating business. So that's one area that people will need to put their minds to and think about. Okay.
Thanks, David. So I am heading up the premium allocation approach subgroup. Like the other subgroups, we've got a broad representation of health insurers, life insurers, and general insurers on the group. What I've got here, just a few of the key points that we're working through at the moment, and there is a bit of an alignment between our group and Benoit's group, so he's already covered a couple of these. But I'll just mention them briefly. So just a reminder also, the premium allocation approach is a simplified approach that can be applied to contracts where the contract boundary is less than 12 months. Okay, so if you have assess the contract boundary. It's less than 12 months, you can use this method. So the first point we've got there is just the eligibility criteria. So you are also able to use the premium allocation approach for contracts that have a contract boundary of greater than 12 months, but there's a few things that you need to do to make sure that that's okay. So the first one is that you need to show that the outcome will not differ materially from building block approach. What does that mean? And Benoit touched on that. And then there's also some wording in the standard around what that the contracts must have not significant variability of cash flows. And again, what does that mean? What do we mean by significant variability in the cash flow? So if the cash flows are significantly variable, then you won't be able to use the premium allocation approach. So just working through some of those subjective issues and the types of contracts that quite often come up in the discussion here are some general insurance warranty type contracts, which are likely to have a contract boundary in excess of 12 months, lenders mortgage insurance, and group risk contracts for life insurers. So those are all where this question will be particularly relevant. I've got an allocation of insurance revenue. Now, both David and Grant spoke about coverage units and the allocation of revenue in line with coverage units under the VFA and the building block approach. For the premium allocation approach, the revenue is allocated on the basis of the passage of time over 12 months, unless there is a significant difference between that and the timing of incurred insurance service expenses, which means essentially incurred claims. So there's some discussion in the subgroup around what that means and how we allow for things like seasonality in the allocation of that revenue. Third point I've got there, onerous contracts, and again, Benoit touched on this, so I won't go through it in too much detail, but effectively you can assume that your groups are not onerous at initial inception unless facts and circumstances say otherwise. Again, very subjective. What does that mean? So that's another open question. Reinsurance is a bit of a tricky one more broadly under AASB 17, and this topic obviously applies to all the methods. But for the premium allocation approach, the key question that we're working through there is around things like risk equalisation schemes and pools, and particularly in health insurance, and how are they going to be treated? Are they reinsurance or are they something else? And the final one I've got there, just the mechanics of this method and differences to what we currently do under AASB 1023. So there are some slight nuances in there that do make it a little bit different. One in particular is how we approach premium receipts and premiums expected to be received. So we're just working through that and how we might get some slightly different outcomes to current approaches. So those are the key issues that we're working through at the moment. There's probably a rag bag of other ones as well, but those are the top five, and we can happy to take questions on that at the end.
Thanks, Brendan. Cool. All right, I just actually want to start by saying thank you to all the members who are assisting in my work stream. It's very much appreciated. So what I've got here is the top five-ish issues that we're dealing with regards to the risk adjustment. For us, it's not immediately obvious there's going to be much change for GI entities. They already hold a risk adjustment for financial reporting. But what they will need to do is actually calculate a gross and reinsured risk adjustment separately, where they might actually already be calculating a net one currently. For life entities, as was previously alluded to, is actually going to be a new explicit component of liabilities. It actually could actually already be reflected implicitly in profit margins if you're using a claims carrier and you're not in onerous. We'll be providing the members with advice regarding the calibration of the confidence level and also the diversification. We know that life entities are likely to leverage their techniques used to derive the risk margin as part of regulatory capital, but we would advise that they will need to ensure that the resulting risk adjustment does meet the AASB 17 requirements. It's really easy in the subjects I've got to get sucked into the detail, and I really enjoy that. But all right, but as Ian alluded to, you have to stand back and think, right, as a board, how does the risk adjustment interact with your tolerance level, your economic capital, and regulatory capital? All right, so it's really important. And it's important that life industry takes a view. What do we want to do regarding the allowance for risk adjustment in regulatory capital? How do we want to work with APRA? Do we want APRA to continue stressing the current estimate to 1 in 200 years and take the risk adjustment and feed it off to capital resources, which is sort of consistent with IAIS international capital standards? Or do we want them to align with the GI entities where they take the 75% risk adjustment and they stress up to 1 in 200? So we should need to take a view on that one. Over the last many years, life entities have actually really developed, and so has GI entities, their risk margin framework. And we know that life entities are probably going to leverage on that, so we'll be providing some advice as to how they need to change that. Also, it's really important, we'll be providing advice on how do you allow for risk mitigation for profit shares, PAR, health claims equalisation, when you're calculating your gross and the reinsured part of the risk margin. Interesting, for profit shares, there's definitely an asymmetry in there. And depending on an arrangement, you can actually reduce your risk adjustment to nil. So just because you might be holding it at 75% doesn't necessarily mean you'll see something in the disclosures, which would be interesting. Lastly, we'll also be providing some simple examples how to actually calculate the different methods, the cost of capital, the confidence level, as well as some simple additions to your margins. The IAA, in association with Deloitte, are actually going to publish a 139-page education memograph. We reviewed it. It's long, very detailed, so we're going to try and give you some simple examples. Right. So the work stream itself is split split ourselves in two. We've got half of us working on the risk adjustment, and half is working on the discount rate. And these are the sort of the key issues that we're also considering. Of course, below those, there's many questions. Don't be fooled. So to make it easy for people, we're going to sort of cherry pick off what Benoit's doing and provide a nice sort of decision tree where you work through, okay, what discount rate I'm going to use at inception, what discount rate I'm going to use at subsequent measurement. And the things we would sort of look, do I need to discount or not? What rate do I use? Should I use a locked-in rate, the current rate, or a rate that's based on the return of the underlying items? So, again, here it's really important. What is actually black and white? What do we actually have to do? And what is actually still open to interpretation? So for us, under the PAA, contracts in the group that have a significant financing component, you will have to discount those. So what exactly does that mean? So just because you're a GI or you're using a PAA doesn't mean you might be able to get away with undiscounting if you actually fall under those requirements. So how do we think it compares to now? Well, obviously discounting is bread and butter for life entities. So we probably think, okay, the rates we're using they're pretty good. But actually every entity will have to actually identify whether the rates they're using meet the AASB 17 principles. For instance, most people have to extrapolate out to a 30-year or 50-year risk-free rate. Is the rate at the point at which you start extrapolating, is that rate liquid enough to meet the AASB principles? Is the ultimate forward rate consistent with current market views? If it's not, then it's not meeting AASB 17 principles. For GI entities, we expect them to continue to undiscount, which is good. But if they don't, we do believe over the next 3 to 4 years there'll be some sort of convergence, because the GI entities are actually imminently going to issue a information note on discounting. It should align some discounting techniques by the time that the AASB becomes in force. We're also providing some advice on bottom-up approach, top-down approach techniques. What can I say about those ones? It's not immediately obvious for us that companies will have to change their view on their liquidity premium. It's already in the AASB 1038. It's going to be in the new one. So if you currently think and you've justified yourself that you don't need it, we believe that you probably still won't need it. What else? Oh, and you can look at 8.7, 8.8 of the AASB 1038. For top-down approach, the only point I want to make in my 5 minutes is that those two don't actually have to reconcile, and you don't have to reconcile them. So they can actually come up with a different rate, depending whether you use a top-down or bottom-up approach. And I won't go into the bottom two. Thank you very much.
Fortunately, I haven't been skiing for a very long time, so I'm now standing in for Wah, who unfortunately is still in hospital. Basically, get to the disclosures. The disclosures are significantly more detailed, and much more disclosure will be required than currently is, and they will drive a major complexity and effort impact on long-term business. So that will primarily affect life insurers, but also affects some GI, those who've got LMI, builder's warranty, and health where you've got overseas student cover, which is commonly 3 or 4 year term business. It's less so the complexity for GI and health for the short term business, but it's still significant change and step up from what we're currently doing. And then having got through all this voluminous disclosure, you also need to step right back and check with yourself. And this is an explicit requirement in the standard, so your auditors will ask you how you actually satisfied this. Have you actually met the overall disclosure objectives and highlighted the right things in all those voluminous numbers everywhere in the back? And basically, what's driving this is they're basically taking the existing IFRS 4 disclosures, and then they've added stuff to it, a detailed reconciliation of the opening to closing balances and all their components thereof. Getting this right will require a lot of thought and effort, as you'll see when I get to my next slide, which will also open up the fun coming there. And then there is details about your new contracts and the CSM, in other words, in our terminology at the moment, the profit margin on your new contracts. So everybody will now know how profitable your business you wrote last year was. And quantitative expected CSM release, that'll be similar to the disclosure of the cash outflows you need to do under IFRS 17. So you need to display how your CSM is expected to release in, say, blocks over the next few years and longer term. Your risk margin approach, having certain of that, you'll have to explain that to the market and confidence intervals. And then eventually at the back end, you have to explain the effect of the regulatory environment on your results and stuff as well. So lots of change there. And now for the nice, fun, simple slide. And this is based on a simple example. That's just a disclosure example. This is a simplified example, you'll be glad to know. But this needs to basically work. Somebody mentioned about all those groups. So you've got portfolios, groups, then you've got cohorts. This needs to work. This needs to be done at that group cohort level. And if you had 4 RPGs, you've probably got about 60 groups and cohorts when you go into transition, and you'll add about 12 or more a year thereafter. So lots to go. And there are now many more points in this reconciliation, because the numbers in there, some of them are actuarial, some are accounting. And the thing that will be easy to do in this process is to spot if it fails to reconcile across all the touch points within the ledger and the accounting disclosures. But if you don't plan this very carefully and well, what will not be easy is figuring out why and where it went wrong and what you should now change. And as we basically explained in our BBA section overview, a number of the items in there, for example, the contractual service margin, the PV cash flows, loss components, and other stuff, will probably also change on consolidation. So you get to redo this table on consolidation completely. So that's about the good news. I'll now hand over back to Ian.
Thank you, guys. I just might ask Rob Sharma from APRA to come up and say a couple of words, then we'll open to Q&A. Thanks.
Thank you, Ian. Good afternoon. As the presentations have highlighted, this is an extremely complicated and complex standard. And internally in APRA, we've started doing some thinking around the standard. And in terms of the likely approach we are likely to take is we're going to do an information request and write to a broad cross-section of entities. Given that the standard is now one standard for all insurance contracts, so it'll affect general insurers, life insurers, and private health insurers, there are different pressure points in the standard and will affect different insurers differently. So the first step before we undertake further change and understand all the incentives with the standard is to collect some information, which we will seek to write to entities about. We'll get the information and we'll analyze it. And I expect that to be conducted probably subject to member clearance in the very near future. So in the next few months, at least the next month or so, we might write and we'll give insurers enough of time, firstly, to work through the questions we are asking. And more importantly, also to get on top of the requirements, which itself are quite complex. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Rob. So I suspect that's generated a few questions for you, so over to you. I'll direct traffic because I won't be able to answer your questions, I'm sure, but my colleagues will be able to. So over to you. So while you're being silent, I'm going to ask David a question. So, David, a very mature traditional product, close to being paid out, it's got very little discretionary benefit left. So can that be captured by VFA? I mean, can it transition from VFA business to non-VFA business?
In terms of, one thing I didn't mention is that the assessment of whether a contract is eligible to use the VFA or not is done at inception of the contract and it stays that way forever. So it doesn't change. So in one answer to your question is it can't transition from VFA to the general model or whatever. The other thing I would say is, and I'd reiterate, basically, to be certain of which method you can use, you need to look at the contract details. We can kind of give an advice of these things are likely to be able to use the VFA or they're likely not to be able to use the VFA, but unless you look at the contract details, you won't know for sure. And even then, you may not know.
Okay, questions? Suzanne.
Apologies, I'm coming late to some of this stuff. So if I can just ask a question about the unbundling, where you talk about investment-linked needing to be unbundled. Are you talking about investment-linked in, say, a variable annuity-type capacity, or are you talking about investment-linked with a risk rider?
I'm talking about the latter, investment-linked with a risk rider. The requirements under AASB 17 is basically... you need to be able to, or one of the tests, that you need to be able to lapse the two components separately for them to be able to be unbundled, i.e. you need to, Grant's going to correct me if I'm wrong. So you need to be able to lapse the investment linked component separately from the rider component, and they need to be able to then operate basically as two separate contracts. If you can't do that, which is often the case with certain older type contracts, you can't, if the investment linked part lapses, then the rider automatically lapses. In which case, you can't unbundle them. They have to be bundled together, and you have to treat that. Even though it's substantially got an investment component, you have to use AASB 17 to measure it.
Now, David's got it right. The other point that's worth mentioning is the test is actually on the contract, and that's a fairly significant outcome in the Australian context with your superannuation business. If you look at a lot of superannuation providers where they've actually got IL and insurance riders, and you actually read the PDSs, they actually explicitly state the insurance component is actually provided through a group life contract. So that's a separate contract from the IL contract, so the unbundling question doesn't come in. However, if you've got ordinary business, you're probably caught. And some of us, unfortunately, are also caught because we actually have par investment options under our investment contracts.
Okay, thank you, guys. More questions? While you're thinking, do you have any questions about what we're doing as a task force? Now, remember, we're doing this to help prepare you for the implementation of the standard, and we've tried to set out how we're tackling that task. So please let us know if you think we're on the wrong path or if you think we should be doing something that we're not. Let us know. Right at the back there.
Question on contract boundaries and grouping. Can one have contracts with different contract boundaries within the same group down to the bottom most granular level?
Contract boundaries and grouping?
I guess the question you'll need to ask is whether the range of risk or are similar, if the boundaries stretch too much between contracts, you may end up with a different take on risk, and therefore you'll need to have different groups, I guess. But again, this is something that we'll need to get our head around as we go through the motion of try to understand what how this works in the standard.
Just wait for the microphone.
There were some references to guidance being developed. Mm-hmm. What connection is there, if any, with whatever that is and anything being developed overseas?
So I mentioned earlier the IAANs. This is the International Actuarial Association notes. We're going to build on them. So they are, from what we've seen, really quite technical. So we're going to build on them and pitch ours at a higher level. We've been in touch with the UK Institute and the Canadian Institute just to see if we can perhaps help each other and leverage off each other's work. But I think we're a fair bit ahead of them at the moment, so that we haven't really gained any benefit from that. But we will continue to do that to try and make sure that we have consistency. Other questions? What about questions for those regulators? Yes.
Is there going to be any guidance on the transitions?
On what, sorry, transitions?
Transitions.
Yeah, I think the answer is yes. But it looks to me to be quite complex. Any particular thoughts from my colleagues?
I'll tackle that first because we're just starting drafting the covering. So the transition in the technical sense is being done under each of the key streams. So one of the topics in my group is transition from policy to following a BBA. There's a separate one, which fortunately for Brendan is quite easy for PAA because they're pretty short-term contracts. And there'll be another one for VFA, which David's picking up. And so we're basically working through what this means. And actually, that's one area where the International Accounting, International Actuarial Association, IAN, is actually quite short, quite readable, And we'll certainly be leveraging that as well as trying to figure out how you actually apply it in the Australian circumstances, which again is another challenge.
Is it correct there are a number of different ways you can manage transition?
You have an opportunity of doing full retrospective, but you probably in practice will go very far back. Hmm. And then after that you've got two options, effectively a modified retrospective, which is where most people want to head. Alternatively, there's fair value, which probably leads to a much lower CSM and a much bigger net equity on your balance sheet.
Hmm. Okay. So I'm sure there is going to be a lot of interest in that issue because of the implications it has for the future as much as anything.
Just an additional comment. You'll have to look for, on your insurance contract, some contracts that are loss portfolio transfer, for example. Really, the duration of the contract will be the runoff of the claims. And therefore, these contracts are quite long-term. So you basically will have to restate and develop a CSM fundamentally on those contracts till the runoff of claims. So if you've offloaded a dust disease runoff claims, well, that will be captured in a transition, and you will have to reassess those.
Okay, thank you. Other questions? Suzanne again. Suzanne's from the regulator. You should be answering questions, Suzanne.
Why do you think I'm asking? Expenses that are not included in the insurance contracts, can you tell me what happens to those? And I'll ask a follow-up question if nobody has another one. So.
Basically, my reading is that they come into your measurement. They still go through your P&L somewhere in your accounts, but they just go through like general overheads and stuff to do with a normal company. They're not tied to a particular product line or anything. So they probably will be in the investor reports so people can understand your results.
So can you just comment then on the implications for the CSM when that happens?
Well, basically what it means is the CSM will be a lot larger, all other things being equal. Remembering risk adjustment will chew a piece of it up as well.
Okay, thank you. More questions? Yep, Duncan.
Thanks, Ian. Can I just check, did I hear right that there aren't any APRA members on the task force? Is that correct?
We have one APRA representative.
Okay. Well, I'll ask my follow-up question anyway, which is from the task force's point of view, what answer do you think APRA should come to on how its capital standards respond to this? as I try, Suzanne's right next to me. I expect him to elbow me any minute. But I mean, at one level, working through all this material, I'm kind of left wondering, well, if you collapse to a short contract boundary, there's no way APRA's going to sort of tolerate just projecting to the end of a one-year contract boundary for a long-term, for what we think of now as a long-term contract. I can't conceive they're going to let you ignore overhead expenses that don't sit in the, you know, that don't sit in the base liability. So at one level, do you think they should be minded just to look through all of this? And if they do, what does that mean for us in terms of, are we running two sets of accounts, one for APRA and one for all IFRS general purpose reporting?
I won't answer that question, but
I'm going to duck around it as well. But I think the answer is likely yes. We will be running two sets of accounts. I think particularly for participating business, you're going to be running, your Life Act accounts and your accounting financial statements. So that's one split that we're going to be stuck with. And then the question is what APRA does on everything else will likely diverge. And I think we've been a bit lucky in this part of the world that we have had alignment. When you talk to other countries around the world, they don't have alignment between regulatory and accounting standards typically. So I wouldn't be surprised if we have some divergence.
I'm not going to put words in APRA's mouth. Do you want to answer the question?
Look, it's probably going to be a fairly unsatisfying answer, but this is exactly the sort of issues that we're going to work through as we get information coming in from the information request and as we learn more about how all of the dynamics of this are going to play out in practice.
One last thing. As a colleague next to me just reminded me, then so this comes in 2021. I suppose I'm wondering, at what point then do we also get the third reporting on appraisal value basis or embedded value reporting? And then we're fully back to the 80s then, aren't we, with new business strains and three different reporting measures. That'd be great.
You're looking forward to it, Duncan, I can tell.
I would suspect that given that the amount of work you've already seen, there's going to be a large amount of pressure to drop something out of the process. And one conversation I've heard in Europe already with a CFO of one of the major, I think it was Prue's CFO, somebody asked them and they basically said, well, I'm doing Solvency 2, I'm doing IFRS 17, I think I've now got everything I need to run my business. I've got a full workload. I'm not going to keep, once it's bedded down, I will probably turn off better values.
Interesting. The issue of transition is very, sorry, issue of early adoption here is obviously very relevant. So, in fact, let's do a little straw poll, just while we've got everybody in the room. So, do you think the company you work for might be interested in early adoption? Any hands up? One, two. Okay, that's interesting. I would have thought maybe more. So there are some companies interested in early adoption.
And they might work for the same company.
They might. they might indeed. But of course, if a company is going to early adopt, then they wouldn't have any choice but to carry on doing the APRA calculations under the existing methodology. So that's technically possible, you early adopt, but you do calculations for APRA purposes just as you do at the present time.
Yeah, and the other thing that's probably worth mentioning on the early adoption question is probably a bit more nuanced. So if you talk to CFO and said this is what it does to your ROE for certain businesses, you will definitely get their attention until you actually explain how much resources they need to pour into it.
To calculate the number, yes.
They get it in there, yeah. And that's kind of the conundrum. So I suspect how many in realistically will ultimately early adopt remains to be seen. My bet is probably not many.
Okay. Anne, did you have a question? Okay, thanks. Other questions? Suzanne?
I just want to ask one about the reinsurance as well. So if the reinsurer has guaranteed premium rates, for a YRT type policy, you're going to end up with the direct insurer reporting on a 1-year contract boundary and the reinsurer reporting on a long-term contract boundary? No?
No, it's much messier than that. basically, we've been in field testing, and as you probably know, we were working on a large reinsurance transaction. So we deliberately asked the ISB while we had a board member in the room, so to speak, by video conference. We said around the accounting standard, we said, we can see our YRT business is short term. By look at the words in the standard, it looks like the reinsurance treaty itself, since the reinsurer won't allow us to reprice it in a year time for them, unfortunately for us, it looks like it's long term. We think this is a flaw in the standard. It should be filed in the underlying. The answer came back from Darrell Scott. No, that's really what we intended. That's not a drafting error.
Sorry, just interpret that a little bit more for the wider audience. So back to Suzanne's question.
The YRT, in your gross YRT, is probably short term.
Yep.
Your reinsurance contract is long term until you can reprice it.
Yeah, and again, for clarity, have to treat them separately at the moment, don't you? Sorry, as proposed, you have to treat them as separate contracts.
And you really now have to make sure that you're measuring each of them individually because you can't do net and add back because it just won't work anymore.
Yep, okay.
In fact, Ian has just said what I was going to say. One thing that you need to actually be mindful of, the gross contract, the underlying contract, and the reinsurance contract, they're totally separate contracts and need to be treated totally separately. They might have totally different rules and in terms of the application of AASB 17, it might be totally different about how you apply it.
Questions? Last chance. Here we are.
I don't actually have a question. I just wanted to express my gratitude to all the people up the front and the whole working group that they're representing for the work they're doing, because I think quite clearly it's a lot of work and it needs to be done.
Yeah, well said. There are actually a lot of people, as one of the guys said earlier, behind the scenes working on this, so, and there is a huge amount of work required, so yes, well said. Okay, no more questions about the task force itself. I just want to reiterate, you know, we need to produce something that that is useful and valuable for you as members. So we've told you what we're where we're heading. You need to tell us if you're uncomfortable. You mean of the task force? Sure. Should have gone the other way. So that's the purpose of the task force. Oops, sorry. Purpose. We will be doing a fair bit more liaising in coming months. What's happening, I think, is the various bodies. So the ATO, for example, has come to grips with this pretty well, I think. Treasury, I think, have a fair handle on it as well. The industry bodies, I'm not so sure. So particularly in the life industry, if you want to go and G up the FSC on the matter, might not be a bad thing. And the various other, so there's activity, it's evolving, but we've got a way to go. And over here are the, that's, this is what we're proposing from a guidance point of view. Yep. Sharanjit.
Thanks. One of the questions put to me by one of my accounting colleagues is, what happens if you know, this task force comes up with some kind of guidance and the accounting bodies who are also looking at this come up with a different type of guidance?
Yeah.
I said I assume they're consulting with each other and looking for consistency, but could you reassure us on that? Or?
Well, I'll try. So, so yes, we have been talking quite openly. And as I mentioned, Anne is chairing the Accounts and Actuaries, the Liaison Committee, which has got this very much in its focus. She attends our meetings. So we're pretty confident that we can keep everybody in sync. And certainly that's our intention. So, you know, when we come out the other end of this, you know, we won't have done our job well if other bodies are critical of what we've produced, I think. Last opportunity. Yes, one over here. Rhiannon.
I might just expand upon that accounting comment, which is to say that this is an evolving area, and so there is entirely possible that things you might have seen up on that screen today, in 6 months' time, one of those things which we were taking as being a fact today might be different in 6 months' time and 6 months after that. So although the task force is working well to sort of keep track of where the international conversation is going and making sure it's aligned, it isn't to say that the international conversation will go where we want it to go. And so those discussions globally will be ongoing. So there's always that possibility that there will end up being a disconnect simply because of timing.
Yeah, it will be interesting, in fact, to see if there's pressure to change the standard. Notwithstanding the fact that it took years and years and years to actually get here.
It's possibly also worth mentioning effectively that, as we mentioned in the coverage unit one and the actual digital, it's very likely that will ultimately go to TRG, and a number of these issues will go to the TRG, and finally we'll get a clear view that this is what the ISB believed they meant. Alternatively, they'll go and change their standard, and they basically promised when they did the original webcast, that effectively they tried to give the companies doing adoption certainty by the end of 2018. So that all the noise is gone by the end of next year, but there'll certainly be a lot more noise and things will quite easily, likely change in significant areas in the course of next year.
Okay.
All right, I might just finish up. We are very aware of this. Yep.
I just want to respond to the TRG comment simply because
I had thought the same as you, Grant, that the TRG was going to be this wonderful place where all these issues could be resolved. My understanding is that IFRS 9, which is of course a similar magnitude standard that's just come in for the banks, there was a similar TRG group set up for that, which turned out to be basically useless. So I think we need to be prepared that the TRG may not be the source of resolution of some of these issues which we thought it might be going to be.
So we are fundamentally structuring our guidance, recognising that the interpretations can change over time, which is why we've got a Q&A coming out this year. And next year, it's only going to be where we are quite confident that we'll put guidance out, or level guidance, because we are safeguarding ourselves against that change of interpretation internationally.
Ian, the letters TRG have been bandied around by a couple of people. Do you want to say what TRG stands for?
Now, I'm not an expert on this, but it is, what is it, Transition Resource Group?
That's right.
I got a tick. Okay, thank you. Okay, last minute. No more questions? All right. Thank you very much for your time. Thank you.